Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Experience summer comfort for less. Explore our sale on curtains and bedding. Perfect time to update and freshen your home.
Now, I saw a story just before we came into studio this afternoon that I have to say made my heart sink, because it's on the RTE website for anyone who wants to see it, and it's about these two adverts that were made by Zara, which is the high street clothing shop that we're all familiar with, and they've been banned by the advertising regulator in Britain because they had models in them who appeared, quote, unhealthily thin. And the models, you know, have protruding collarbones and are styled in a certain way that they look really, really skinny. And just looking at it, I felt like I'd been transported back 25 years to when, I think we'll all remember it, we had the size zero. You know, everyone was aiming towards, or supposed to be aiming towards, this size zero. It was a really big thing. And do we remember the Spice Girls being asked their weight live on air, and the whole thing that was around weight and skinniness at the time, and how damaging it was to so many young women and indeed young men as well. And just to see this making a comeback from where we were, where I felt we were, where it was healthy and strong. That's what we were aiming for. Just made me so sad. But we have Anne-Marie Gannon on the line, who knows all about this. Anne-Marie, and you're really welcome. You were Miss Ireland in 1985. So you were right in the middle of the whole skinny trend, I suppose, the last time it was here, if you can call it a trend. What do you think of what you see here?
Hi, Sarah. Thank you very much for having me on. I'm actually really annoyed. I'm. Yeah, you're right. I remember the 00. I was Miss Ireland in 1985. I was a healthy size 10, 12. I got into modelling then in kind of after the 80s, the late 80s. I moved abroad in 89. And I started to work for international agencies. Regularly, you get measured if you were size 8. I remember being sent off saying, no, I wasn't small enough. And at the time, and mentally in my own head, I wasn't in a great place because I just lost my mother before I went away. And there was all sorts of stuff going on. And I actually took up smoking to stay thin. Mm. And I just, what annoys me, I mean, fair dues to the British advertising standards taking these down, because back then you could open a magazine, close it and put it away.
Yeah.
Nowadays you can't do that. You're on your TikTok, or you're on your Instagram, or you're on your Facebook, or you're on screens all the time, and these ads continuously come up. Yeah. Back in the noughties, we had, you know, very slim Kate Moss style, and as you were saying, the size zero, which is impossible for anybody. Who would want to be a size zero anyway? As a female, we should all be embracing ourselves, and we should be embracing the uniqueness and the different sizes of that females should be allowed to be. But what I'm very concerned about is, because nowadays with the social media platforms, it's targeting a younger cohort.
Yeah.
And mental health and anorexia or bulimia, or, you know, they're beginning to start younger and younger nowadays with the huge mental health issues we have. And high street brands or designer brands or whatever brand you are, you have no right to present a campaign where you are putting it in front of a vulnerable young girl or boy, and they feel that this is what they must attain to.
Yeah, so I just wonder, okay, so, and I'm very conscious this could be a triggering conversation for plenty of people. So rte.ie/helplines, if, you know, this is a conversation that you find difficult, or if you need some help around this conversation. I want to ask you, Anne-Marie, just because they brought up so many interesting points there, but for yourself and your own experience, you know, when you're getting measured and you're being told you're not small enough in size and you're taking up smoking to try and lose weight, was there anybody at the time saying, hold on a second, you're beautiful?
No.
You know, you're perfect. What?
My friends.
No, really?
That was it. I just brought up when I actually was living abroad, and it was a very important casting I went to. And I remember my agent in Dublin ringing me because I was a size 10 at the time and asking me what I had for my breakfast. And I remember my sister going, get out of it. Do you know what I mean? That was the support I had, my family, my sisters, and a couple of my friends were telling me. But you know what? Their opinion wasn't the one that counted. It's like, I have a daughter, and I know that mum's opinions aren't always the ones that count. It's what is appealing to the masses that counts. And that's where brands and ourselves have a responsibility to ensure that we don't trigger anything with somebody that's in a vulnerable position that feels this is what they must look like, or this is what the body must look like, or, you know, if they don't fit into the size 6 jeans, or I'm so angry that I thought that this was something companies were much better in keeping with and, you know, being aware of than just disregard.
You know, and I thought,
you know what I mean?
Thought it was done. You know, I thought that was over very naively, perhaps, you know, that it was over. But just I'm not going to say in defence of Zara, but maybe to put what Zara seems to be doing, and I'm sure there's other companies doing it as well, in context. You know, as you say on social media, I have noticed, I don't know if you've noticed on platforms like TikTok and Instagram and other platforms, that there is a conversation now that has moved away from the strong and healthy towards skinny. Like there's even this whole trend of I'm not 2025 skinny, I'm early 2000 skinny, with people, you know, posting all these videos of themselves looking, you know, much skinnier than, you know, what you would expect. So, you know, I think there seems to be a general trend, doesn't it?
I don't even want to call it a trend because I dread that it becomes one.
I agree.
I really believe that, like, if you have a young daughter, you have a young child, you have a young niece, whatever, at home, or you know, even boys are susceptible to this and what it must look like, and they're pounding the pavement and they're, you know, they're doing whatever it is to try and be the smallest size possible they can to follow this 2000 trend, as it's out there, it's on social media. We need to be aware that it's out there, that it exists, but we also need to be aware of the young people, or, you know, the people that are in our lives, and keep an eye on them.
Yeah, we see, this is the thing,
because
right?
It so we'll say one thing.
Exactly. And the problem is, if you're on social media, because I out of interest, I looked up a couple of these videos because I was interested in seeing what that conversation was like and what was happening. And then I started getting all the videos recommended to me, you know, along the same lines, you know, and we've heard about the algorithm and we talk about the algorithm. But next thing, a lot of the stuff in my timeline was about weight and about how you should look. And it was 100%. All this really, really negative, you know, difficult messaging. Can I bring you back again, Anne-Marie, for a second? And I'm really interested to hear from children of the 90s or 80s, such as myself and yourself, Anne-Marie, if you had these experiences and what it was like, you know, what difference you think it made to your life. 0818 715 815, if you want to get in touch, or you can text us on 51551. Just in terms of your own career, Anne-Marie, when you were dealing with this, so did you get out of the industry because of it, or do you think you lost jobs because of it, or how did that all play out for you?
No, I think what happened was realisation came in. I remember fabulous journalist Jonathan Philbin Bowman, used to be pals years and years ago, and he hadn't seen me in a couple of years because I'd been abroad, and bumped into him in town, and we were going to grab a cup of coffee, and he said to me, "Oh my God, Anne-Marie, I won't tell you what he called me, but he goes, you know, I was no longer a gazelle. I'll say it like that, right?
Okay.
I was more like the skeleton of the gazelle. But anyway, and that woke me up. That kind of shook me into saying, "Oh God, what does he see that I don't? Do you know what I mean?" And I look back on pictures, family photos, and stuff. And I was that model with the bones sticking out. You know, I'm going back. God, if my daughter looked like that, I'd be worried sick. Do you know what I mean? But no, I think.
But you couldn't
see
it.
I came back home. Sometimes you can't see the wood for the trees when you're in the wood. And that's what worries me, because you have to walk into that wood. And it's things like these campaigns get you to walk into that wood if you're vulnerable. And then you're in the wood and you cannot see the wood for the trees. And it's that switch. It's at that very big entrance to that wood where you think, well, that there's a model and I'm in this industry and that's what I need to look like. And then the girl that wants to look like the model, the innocent girl that could be a schoolgirl, she could be a civil servant, could be anything, wants to look like this girl as well. So she follows through and starts to fast and starts to starve and starts to do these things. It's a trigger. Now, we all know there's underlying things. It's your vulnerability that can separate what's rational to what is healthy. There's two different ways. It depends on the state of mind you're in, number one, and if you're feeling inadequate. And I have to say this about social media. I don't know how social media has done more good to young people than bad. There seems to be an awful lot of triggers with mental health lately. It's a huge issue here. And this is just that whole 2010, that 2010 thing can trigger a very serious mental health problem.
Well, of course it can.
And that's
yeah.
what concerns me.
Yeah,
that's
because
really
as you say,
me.
You could close the magazine, you know, and the magazine wasn't
yeah.
in your pocket the
yeah.
whole time. And those magazines
no.
that were so damaging as well, you know, in terms of the
yeah.
messaging. But at least, you know, you only got it once a week and, you know, you were done with it and it was gone. It wasn't being fed to you. It wasn't being made for you, really, which is what the algorithms
yeah.
are doing. So that leaves... And, you know, I think it's interesting what you're saying as well about people being vulnerable and, you know, they're those would be the people most at risk. But my memory of it, Anne-Marie, is that everyone I knew in my age group in the sort of the late 90s and early 2000s was aware of and very conscious of their weight. And it was just, there
yeah.
was, you know, and the size zero. And as I said, people being weighed, people being, celebrities being asked about their weight on air, actresses being asked, you know, are you too chubby for that role? You know, and all of this messaging constantly coming at you. So
yeah.
you didn't have to be vulnerable to be affected by it, you know?
No, but I think if at least if you have some sense of strength, but if you have a vulnerability in your mind, and I think there's our young people today are very vulnerable because of, you know, we went through the pandemic, we've done all that, we've the lack of social skills and everything else. How do they open up? How do they talk? You know, and their whole, their friends are on the screen. And I do think that it's a different wave than it was now in 2000 than it is now. Because as you say, we have the algorithm pal that's going, you could look like this, you can look like this, you can look like this, you can look like this.
You should look like this.
And that keeps going on and on and on and on and on. You should look like this.
Yeah.
And I think that is where we have to be so careful. And I am so glad that Sarah was told to take them down. I really am.
Anne-Marie, thank you so much for talking to us this evening, or this afternoon rather. If you want to get in touch, 0818 715 815,
Sarah,
the text number is...
Sarah, apologies.
No, that's okay. 51551 if you want to text us. The WhatsApp number is 0874 84 88 88. And again, if you've been affected by anything in that conversation, you can go to rte.ie/helplines.
Lifeline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.
I'm James Elder with UNICEF, and I've been to Gaza. I've met the terrified mothers who know that their love isn't enough to feed their children. I've met the starving children in hospital too weak to cry. They need food. They need it now. UNICEF is delivering life-saving therapeutic food, but we urgently need your support. I've seen donations from Ireland bring hope where there was none. Please visit unicef.ie and help save a child's life today. Thank you.
The Ray Darcy Show, weekdays from 3 on RTE Radio 1.
It's Brendan Courtney in for Ray this Wednesday afternoon. Coming up at 3, we'll be exploring life at the iconic Kylemore Abbey, the subject of a new documentary series. Budgeting Queen Kaz Mooney will help us take care of the pennies so the pounds can take care of themselves. And with the new Naked Gun reboot earning rave reviews, we revisit some of our all-time favourite slapstick comedies. And of course, we'll have the 1-2-3 quiz just after 4. Email ray at rte.ie if you'd like to get involved, and we'll talk to you after
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. The outlook just got even brighter with further reductions all summer. In store or at harrycurry.com.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.
Elizabeth joins us on the line. Elizabeth, good afternoon. What can you tell us?
Good afternoon. Hi. I suppose just it's the reflection of the back to school and the cost for getting a kid through the school year. I have two now in secondary, one through, and already before I don't need to be buying books this year, which is a welcome relief. It's the first time in 14 years that I don't have to be buying a book for any child. So I'd have one going transition year and another lower down in the secondary school year, but I've already spent between €800 and €900 because I have one doing a TY tour, and I have €400 already paid down on the deposit for that, and that tour will be next May, April, May time. Now, at least they give you the opportunity to pay it off in instalments, but, you know, we have fees for lockers and photocopying. For each child is €100, there'd be, I'd say, 250 out of 500 that has to be paid for, even going into TY for the other activities that they'll do. And, you know, I was also just reflecting back on, you know, say from June 2024 until May this year, I checked the school app, you know, all the payments that you have for any incidentals. And it was €1,502 I paid. That's outside of any books. That was all for, there was non-uniform days, there was retreats, junior cert exams, leaving cert exams, concerts, a couple of study blocks, you know, for, you know, at least, you know, and it's not all mandatory. I mean, to have after school study in exam year, sometimes that's helpful. But it was even the pre-junior cert exams was 90, the leaving cert was 130. Journal, locker, the under pouch is 190. The voluntary health contribution or voluntary parent contribution last year was 450. And again, the first year it was done in, you know, allowed to pay it in instalments. You know, it's just all the incidentals. Could be a retreat, could be a cinema trip that the year group took.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, that's just.
And it adds up, and it adds up, and it adds up, and you end up with, as you say, a bill of about knocking on €1,000 by the sounds of it to get them back to school, and then €1,500 when they're back at school. Talk to me about the voluntary contributions, because I know there's been a bit of there's always some concern over that and questions over that about how voluntary it is. Do you feel it's voluntary?
Well, I've always paid it. I paid for my kids all through primary school, and that was 120 year, and I just paid that as a tenner a month. I always felt, you know, it's voluntary. Yes, it is. And people can maybe choose to pay it or not to pay it. I could see when you could see the books, the library set up, the different things that the school would invest in, because, you know, it is for the benefit of the children. Mm. So that is the way I always looked at it. It's not that it's going into, you know, a coffee machine for the teacher staff room or something like that. And that'd be, you know, funny about it. It was for the students. When it comes to secondary, obviously, it's up a notch. I think what I did find, at least last year, the relief that it was allowed to be paid in instalments, because what would happen is it would start in June before they'd start back, and you'd get a reminder through this app constantly, voluntary contribution, voluntary, you haven't paid the voluntary contribution.
Yeah.
And it's just like an extra monkey on your back, because it's not voluntary when you've been, it's like the bank asking you for, you know, you've defaulted on a payment. Here's the, you know, the default letter, I suppose, in a way to kind of maybe... It is a pressure, but at least, you know, now going forward, I have one less in secondary, but I can pay it in instalments.
You've got your college fees to look forward to now, maybe, Elizabeth, or maybe you don't. I don't know if they're heading that direction.
Well, hopefully. Yeah. But even in that, with one going into transition year, you know, we were given the talk there around Easter time, and, you know, the school trip is, and again, it's optional, but, like, is it really?
Is it really? Yeah.
Like, yeah. It's €1,000, and that's before... That's just to pay for the trip, and then because it's a trip abroad, and then you'd have, having had a child on a trip before, then you have, you know, what they need, the spending money for the few days. They might need, I don't know, there might be something coming up to it, even if you try and do it on a minimal budget, you are looking, and then, you know, spending money for their food. You know, you have to give them a float of a couple of hundred quid. That I think that the teachers maybe take some control of, and you know, and I did get it back, whatever was left over back for my daughter. But just transition year alone, we were kind of told to earmark about €2,000, because you have the trip, and then you have the it's €500 then for the other, maybe it could be a outdoor activity pursuits kind of day, or trip for a couple of nights, might be a trip up to Knock, might, you know, it's buses, it's...
That is extraordinary pressure, isn't it, on parents and on kids? Because as you say, it's, you know, is it voluntary? Can you have your kid being the one going in? Well, I'm not going because we can't afford it, or trying to make up an excuse as to why they're not going. And also, you want them to have the experience. Obviously, you want them to have the experience. But I mean, that is pricey.
It is pricey. And I have to say, in both the primary and secondary school scenarios, they were never individually made feel, or it was never said to them, your parents haven't paid for this or for that. But having kind of volunteered at school for a long time, and knowing through the parents' associations and the meetings you'd have where the forum would come up to discuss some of these things, I think a lot of things is what parents wanted to know, and it came up constantly in the primary school, is notice. Don't tell us that there's a bus going to a football final for the school, and ask them the night before for the money. You know, at the start of the year, tell us you're going to need a slushy fund of 100 euros to have in cash, or 50 yeah. euros. So when there's a wear what you want day, or there's like buses for, you know, a sports activity, that they have, that parents are aware, because people are living paycheck to paycheck, week to week, month to month.
Yeah.
I know for my daughter's school tour, I've already started paying it. And I'll pay a bit a month, so by the time the trip comes in April, May time, it's not, oh, now I need 800 euro.
Yeah. Okay, stay with us, Elizabeth, for the moment. 51551 if you want to get in touch. And I really would be interested in hearing from schools, principals or teachers, because I know from having spoken to them in the past and even in my own personal life, I know an awful lot of teachers, that schools really struggle with this. They hate asking parents for money. They really hate asking parents for money, but they find that, you know, they spend a lot of their time fundraising, I think. 0818715815 if you want to call the programme. And Niamh is on the line. Niamh, what's your situation?
Well, I'm not as in a bad situation as that lady with her 450 euro fees,
Elizabeth,
but I
yeah.
still feel, yeah, that the fees are extraordinary. This year is the first year in 6 years, my eldest is in 6 year, that I haven't had to pay over 200 euro in fees because of the book scheme. So his voluntary contribution is 100 euros. My youngest is in sixth class and his contributions, including his insurance, come to 109. And then my daughter is the one who I was a little bit miffed about, because her school is incredibly expensive in itself, in that the uniform when she went in last year in first year was over 300 euros. And I was told in advance, I was kind of warned really, look, this school is expensive. You know, the tracksuit bottoms are brand named. Everybody has to wear the branded jacket. You have to have a specific type of very expensive shoes, you know, and I get that they want everybody to be uniform and there's no differentiation between people's circumstances. But actually what they have done is kind of made the school the brand. So you have to have the branded jacket. You have to have the Dubarry shoes, you know, the branded jumpers. And there's a different jumper for the senior cycle. So you wouldn't even get away if you had a smaller child, she didn't grow much. You wouldn't even get away with using the same jumper after third year. So like last year, I bought her uniform a good size too big. And now she complained and it's too long and the whole lot. But it was the only way to make it last to this year. So I kind of got away with that this year. But what annoyed me, I have to say, when I saw the fees coming in, was this book deposit that we have to pay. And it's a book deposit for the free book scheme. Now I've had a little bit of time to have a look it up, and they're within their rights to charge it, but I'm just querying why they would choose to charge it this year when there's so many other expenses and the cost of living and the price of shopping and everything. So now it's hanging over my head, this 50 euro book deposit, and whether I should pay it or not.
So you have to pay that, I presume, so that when at the end of the year you give the books back, you get your deposit back. I presume that's the idea.
Yeah, apparently that's the idea. So they're within their rights to charge it, to kind of encourage good maintenance on the books. And when you hand them back, you get the deposit back. But presumably when you go back the following year, you're going to have to pay it again for the next lot of books that you get. And so it goes on.
So your issue is when you have all these other expenses, the new uniform and the voluntary contribution, the photocopying charge and all the other extra bits, that this 50 euro is sort of the straw, basically, for you, that's breaking the camel's back.
Absolutely is. Yeah, it absolutely is. I just looked at it and I thought, where are they going with this? You know, like it's upped the fees from 140 last year to 180 this year. And that's before I buy a pair of shoes or, you know, anything like that. I mean, I had in my mind, I went through the wardrobes, I pulled out all the uniforms, I checked the sizes, try them on again, make sure everything fits. So I kind of thought in my mind, right, 500 euros will get me what I need plus the fees. And then I saw this extra 50 euros and I thought, oh my God, like, you know, such a time to decide to add this on to the long list of everything else. You know, like stationery alone, I bought pens and pencils and I didn't go to an expensive shop. I went to kind of one of those places where you get 3 for 5 or whatever. And even the stationery cost me 85 euro.
Oh,
and that's just pens and pencils, you know.
How many pens and pencils did she get?
I know. Well, three sets of children, highlighters for leaving cert year, post-its for, you know, note making, that kind of stuff. But you know, just the bare minimum. I didn't even buy colouring pencils for every kid, like, because I went through the pencil cases and pulled out what was still reasonably good. And, you know, like, so I think I'm fairly okay at reusing things and making sure that the uniform might last an extra year.
Yeah. Can I ask you about the uniform, Niamh? Because I find this fascinating, because, you know, you hear this year on year that parents don't want crests on uniforms. They just want generic ones they can get in Dunnes or whatever. And yet, you know, schools persist. And it strikes me that, not all schools, but some, it strikes me that surely schools are persisting because there must be some demand from some parents to have the crested uniforms. Like, is there a status thing going on here, you know, that you look the part, or, you know, you represent the school, that you're very obviously from a particular school. Do you think that's part of it?
Yes, I do think so. I do think so. I know a good few years ago now, when my daughter was still in primary school, a survey went out to all the parents about whether they wanted branded uniforms or non-branded uniforms. And to my shock and horror, it came back that the majority wanted branded. And I do think, like, it's definitely a status thing. Like, I don't understand why you would have to wear a particular type of shoe that you can only get in a particular shop at a particular price. And it's the same for another school in our area, a boys' school. My daughter's in an all-girls school. The all-boys' school have the same thing, this type of loafer that they wear. And the minute you see those shoes, you know what school they're from. And it just boggles the mind, you know, as to why. Like, when I was in secondary school, we had a very, blazer, the whole lot, and everybody had to wear it. But the shoes were up to you. And, you know, the jacket wasn't a branded jacket. You could wear any jacket as long as there wasn't a visible brand name on it. And again, that was so that if you couldn't afford that brand name, it wasn't obvious to your peers that it was because you couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
Whereas now it's all branded jackets. My eldest in sixth year has to wear a branded jacket or no jacket. And my daughter is the same, branded jacket or no jacket. And they're very expensive coats. They're very expensive. And you don't wear them during the rest of the year because you're not going to school.
Elizabeth, I might bring you back in here in terms of the uniforms. Yeah. Is there a second-hand market for even the branded stuff, do you think? Or is that a way around it?
It is a way around it. And I know certainly through primary school, we would have had uniform banks, and we even kind of raised the number of times you could get that through the year. So a kid who's had a growth spurt from September to December, and then we could do a uniform bank in January, and then maybe again in June. And you would, you know, and then kids who passed on, you know, passed on into secondary school, parents would drop back off their uniforms, and everything was sold for kind of a couple of euro. And we had found particularly in the last couple of years I'd been involved, that the volume of people coming to get those uniforms and shirts or tracksuits and what have you was increasing. There'd also be kind of lost and found. And funnily enough, as Niamh has mentioned about the branded jackets, we would find branded items that had been left in the halls and corridors. Parents would be contacted by email saying, you know, there are items to be collected, and nobody would come and collect them, and collected, and they would be sold on. And I do know that the secondary schools that I'm aware of do have that option as well.
Okay.
To buy secondhand. And I myself had done it. Even the school jacket was 60, 70 euro, and my third child went in. They don't like them. They don't want to wear them. They're not comfortable. And I said, I'm not, you know, paying. I got it for maybe 15 euro.
Okay, so that is, there are ways, yeah, there are ways around it. I suppose the question that maybe parents have to ask themselves is, or maybe the whole lot of us have to ask ourselves is, maybe not, but do we want to pay more tax so that the schools can be funded properly, so that parents don't have to pay individually when it comes to the beginning of the school year?
Well, I don't know.
I don't expect you to have the answer to that question. I'm just throwing it out there, because I think, you know, like, we talk about it every year, don't we, in terms of the cost of going back to school and the problems in the voluntary contribution, but then we hear from the schools they have no money. You know, so where is the fix?
It's hard, and again, whether you're asking that to be answered, it is hard to know. I think it's just people boxing clever about, you know, you can invest in a something like I don't know, is it okay to say the name, a Jansport black backpack, and that will last the 6 years or the 5 years. Kids don't need new pencil cases and it's not being a Grinch every term. As Niamh said, dig out the old pencil cases, find out what's working, what's not.
Yeah, okay.
The deposits for the books coming in, you know, I would know from what my own have said, that since the books came in the last year or so, there are kids who don't care then about the books. They're, as in, they're left around the corridors.
The free and maybe books, that's where I schools understand.
Are saying, yeah, saying, yeah, look, you need to put a value on these because they still have to be paid for. And if they need to be replaced, then there's a cost to that to the school as well, an additional cost.
Okay, well, look, if you want to get in touch on this topic or anything else we're discussing today, you can text us to 51551, the phone number 0818 715 815. Elizabeth and Niamh, thank you so much.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.
Oliver Callan, weekdays from 9 a.m. on RTE Radio 1 and the RTE Radio app.
Sligo surfer Garode MacDade. So we have some of the best waves in the world here, don't we?
Yeah, like a lot of people don't know how good the waves are actually in Ireland. And there's hundreds and hundreds of waves that are top quality and some of the best in the world. We have to deal with some storms and winds and stuff, but when everything aligns and comes together, there's nowhere else in the world I'd rather be.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
RTE Radio 1. Deacon Blue presents the Great Western Road Trip, live at 3 Arena Dublin, 8th of October 2025. Tickets available now from Ticketmaster and singularartists.ie. Deacon Blue, live at 3 Arena Dublin. Proudly presented by Singular Artists.
Music updates on RTE Radio 1.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Bringing you great savings on curtains and bedding. Available all year in store and online at harrycurry.com.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Well, if you were listening yesterday at the end of the programme, you may have heard Marie, who had rescued Seagull and was very concerned about the Seagull because she was minding it in a cage in her bathroom and didn't know what to do with it. So she took the Seagull. We've got some good news on this. She took the Seagull to a vet in Charlemont Street and all he needed was a bit of R&R. So he's now back in the skies. I don't know, did she ever name him? But he's back in the skies anyway and healthy. And speaking of animals, we've got Anne Maloney on the line. And Anne, you have a problem, like a really quite a serious problem.
Yes, I do. I have a little Jack Russell's dog, little bitch, called Penny, and Penny suffers from what the vets are calling grass allergy.
Of all the things for a poor little doggy to have, a grass allergy.
I never heard of it. Anyway, I lived in the city at that stage and I couldn't understand. Right, we'd walked in the park once or twice, but it was mainly on the street, and she was still getting it, and she had to get an injection every month to help her cope with it, help us all cope with it.
And cope with what now? Hold on. Tell me a little bit about Penny. She's small little
Penny
Jack Russell. What's she like as a dog?
She's a lively little thing and is the light of our lives, and she's just a beautiful little dog, beautiful shiny coat, real shiny coat, always had.
Big personality.
And, oh, sure, Jack Russell thinks they're Rottweilers.
I know, I love
every
them.
They're dare dogs and all the well, they make a lot of noise from time to time, but she's just the light of our lives, you know, and she's a real pet but a spunky little dog, you know. But if we are out, you know, if she meets new people, she can be very shy at times. But that's until she gets to know them, you know.
Yeah. And what age is she?
2.
Oh, she's only 2. So when did you notice then, how did you notice there was an issue, you know, to get onto the grass allergy? Like what did it show up
as? It started as a rash on her underside, on her paws. And on her belly.
Okay. And you and noticed her scratching or whatever, did you? Or trying to scratch yourself?
Oh, scratching it, yeah.
Yeah.
And when I took her to the vet, that's what they told me. And I couldn't understand it because we'd been on very little grass at that stage. You know, even when we go in the park, she would be walking on the path mainly, not on the grass. You know?
I suppose, and you know, but like if it's anything like humans who have an allergy to grass or pollen or whatever, you know, if it's around, if it's in the air, I don't know now, obviously, I'm not a vet. But.
Well, I'm beginning to learn that part, that side of it. I didn't understand that part of it first. But it's more, I believe it's more kind of pollen related now than the actual grass itself, if you know what I mean.
So did the vet know immediately then when the vet saw the rash, like was this, that's a grass allergy, or did they have to do blood tests or, you know, tests, different types of, how quickly did they find
out? No, that's what they told me the first day, and they gave me, after a little consultation, and they gave her an injection to help with it, and she had to get that every month then to help with it.
And that's the steroid injection?
Yeah, and then we've had to move, and we're living out the country now.
Oh no! So you're surrounded by grass. I'm sure she does. Okay.
You know. Yeah. Well, now all the vets I've spoken to, and I've spoken to a few at different times, they all say you can't keep a little dog off grass.
No, sure you can't.
You just can't. Like it's their natural, it's their second natural state. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And where they want to be. But it has got worse this year. It's got a lot worse this year. And I've had to go to a different vet. And I must say, they've been extremely nice to me and extremely good to me. And a different type of injection, but with the same outcome, you know.
Okay, so the steroid injection worked last year. Penny was in her element. Yeah. She was able to be out in the grass and she wasn't getting any reaction or anything. But it's not working as well this year, is it not?
No, it's not. She got that actually. I've had different brands of the injection this year. But last after the week, I had to take her and she got the same injection that I used to get in the city. And it didn't work at all.
So is she driven cracked? She
had us nearly driven cracked as well as herself.
Yeah.
Poor thing. She didn't even have enough paws and mouths to scratch one night last week.
Ah, no, the poor pet. So do you have to put a cone in her? Like, could she hurt herself?
No, I didn't. No, I couldn't do that to her. No, when you have two little eyes pleading, would you like to do something for me, you know?
Yeah.
And she was really pleading, and she... You know, she had her back legs going and her front legs going and her mouth going, trying to get all the bits that were itching. Do you know that kind of way?
Yeah. And that was you're saying that was last weekend, is it?
Last week, yeah.
Last week.
The week before last, no. Okay. So she went and got an injection on the Saturday, last Saturday week. But I had to take her yesterday evening as well.
It's probably a huge cost to that as well, Anne, is she? I know that's not the most important thing, like you want to help Penny, but it's probably not cheap.
It's not, but look, it's like everything. It's like if you have a child, you have to look after them. You have a dog, you have to look after it. That's the way I look at it. And all right, it is a bit expensive, but so is living sometimes.
Yeah. No, I know, sure, if you have a pet, as you say, you're taking on that responsibility and you look after the pet and you do anything now to... So she got the injection last week, but your concern is it won't last again another month. Like, this is wearing off too quickly. It's not giving her the same bump or protection.
It didn't work at all this time.
Oh, no.
So yesterday, early in the day, we had cut the grass in the lawn and, she had great fun. She went out yesterday and had absolute great fun. She took out one of her ties and she was flying around playing. And you really couldn't have called her in, though.
No.
You know? And the next thing, later in the afternoon, there she had, the rash was out and it was bright red.
Oh.
And not blisters, but bumpy, you know. Like when you'd look at it initially, you could think there was blisters on it, but it was bumpy.
Yeah, so it's worse than it's ever been.
Like if anybody saw her, they would think I was neglecting her.
Really? You know? Oh, no. This is terrible. This is terrible.
It is, yeah. It is.
So what... has the vet got any...
And she goes out for food and everything. It seems to be... It then comes from her lower jaw all the way along underneath her to her tail.
Okay.
You know, and every place is bright red, her paws, her belly, her chin, you know.
And has the vet any other solutions? Like, is this all they have? A steroid injection? Is this the only thing they've...
It's a kind of, it seems to be, she got a non-steroid injection as well, which would have the same benefits of a steroid one. And that seems to work. Like, nothing is working to get rid of it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean. And the vet isn't anxious that she'd have steroid injections all the time, that she's too young to get them all. You know?
And do you notice, is it this a summer thing, you know, like if it is related to pollen, you know, some people's hay fever gets worse in the summer or around particular times of year. Like, was she okay during the winter?
She wasn't too bad.
Okay.
She wasn't too bad.
Okay, so it's a bit seasonal,
right. You know,
she'd
get a little I suppose you could say, you'd know that she was pinker than she should be. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
All right. She wasn't scratching as much or anything. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So for the outcome that she'd be out in the grass and maybe go for a walk up the woods or that kind of thing, she might come back with, you know, her underside a little pink, but it would be no big problem, you know? But like, I wouldn't dream of taking her up there now. She couldn't enjoy it.
No, this is, I don't really know what to say about it. I know that you can get the artificial grass. You know, I don't know if that's something you've considered. Would that be any good to her? I don't know how expensive that is. And that would be very limited area anyway, wouldn't it? I don't know. Would you even have room for it?
No, we wouldn't. It wouldn't work here in the setup here, you know. And it's on a small farm, so it wouldn't work on it, you know. No, we'll just have to keep plodding. And
okay, well hold on now, before you plod, Anne, because I think we've Siobhan on the line, and this is Rung a Bell with Siobhan. Siobhan, you're very welcome. You weren't surprised to hear there's such a thing as a dog with a grass allergy.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me on. Yes, we have a 15-year-old Labrador retriever. She's good age at this stage, but I'd say now for the last maybe 10 years, she's had a grass allergy as well. It's actually the grass pollen that she's allergic to. So I think even if she doesn't go on grass, like, she's still going to get it from the pollen.
Okay.
She's still going to get her allergy just from the pollen that's floating about in the air. No matter how much you keep them off the grass, they're just going to get it.
And you know, does it show up the same way as Penny's allergy is showing up, you know, sort of red, itchy, irritated?
Yeah, no, so our dog, Ollie, she it's just bite, itch, scratch, bite. Itch, scratch all the time, you know, so she kind of has her legs kind of worn away. The skin and the hair, like if we don't give her, we have her on a very effective tablet, which our vet put her on. It's not a steroid, but it's quite expensive.
Okay.
So, but that has, like, as soon as she goes on that, it's just calm, you know, and it really works. It's a daily tablet. And yeah, so that's a huge help for our lovely girl.
Okay, well, that might help Anne and Penny out. So the tablet, what's the tablet called?
The tablet is called Apoquel.
Okay.
Now, it's pretty pricey. I think it's like 80 or 90 euro for a month's supply.
Okay.
And she takes it daily. But she only has to take it during the summer months.
Okay, so you've noticed the same as Anne then, that it's not as bad. Does she have any reaction during the winter?
No, in the winter she's fine.
She's fine.
So no tablet at all in the winter. But it kind of starts up in April. And if we don't put her on the tablet pretty early on, you know, she can get, you know, quite a bad reaction to it. So we have to kind of put her on the tablet around April time.
Just okay, preventative, sort of.
Growing.
Yeah. Yes. It's exactly like the rest of us, isn't it? You know, who suffer from allergies like myself and hay fever and things like that. So do we think Apoquel is a antihistamine, or do you know, is it the effective sort of dog antihistamine?
I'm not sure if it's an antihistamine. It's definitely not a steroid, but I know it works. It's very, very good. I think it's the only kind of one on the market, so it is expensive. But we get it from our vet, and it's kind of a lifesaver for our girl.
Okay. Siobhan, thank you very much.
Yeah.
We have, you might stay with us, we have Afra Cronin now as well, who thinks she might have a solution.
Yeah.
Afra?
No, I haven't a cure, Sarah, but I did breed West Highland Terriers at some stage, and my husband was a vet. And any animal with pale skin, white skin, or white hair.
Yeah.
Cats and dogs, they tend to have more problems in the allergy line. Now, whether that's the case with the little Jack Russell, she sounds in an awful state altogether.
Yeah.
But that's what we used to do, bread soda, big heap of bread soda into cool water, and one particular dog, and she'd walk in and sit in.
Oh, you know, I could imagine how that would help. So this is just to sort
it
of
just,
relieve.
It doesn't cure. It won't cure. But if it was left available and she got to know I mean, animals are very clever to look after themselves, really, when they find something that helps, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
so how
you
long...
know, I don't notice, so... if you've ever noticed, you know, white-eared cats and dogs, they tend to get cancer of the ear. You know, white is really difficult. I don't want to put people off.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying, though, because, I mean, a Labrador is, you know...
They seem to be more prone. They seemed to be more prone. But my husband was a great believer in some of the old cures. We had a pony once that got what they called a kind of an R. It's on the mane, but it's actually a midge that starts laying in the mane of the pony. And he did bread soda all the time and finally cured it. Now, time might have done it as well. I don't know.
Okay. But so, can I ask you, do you know how long to sit the doggy in the bath
no,
with the bread
no,
soda?
No, no. The dog will choose. The dog will okay. choose herself.
Okay.
That was my experience. It was only one dog it happened with, actually.
Okay.
And we never found out. This is years and years ago now. And I'm afraid Tom wouldn't rather, you know, well, he didn't send off to the laboratories or anything like that.
Okay.
To find out what the allergy was to, and we didn't have that kind of equipment back then.
Yeah, okay. So let me go back to Anne and see. Anne, what do you think of all that for Penny?
Just a practical thing to do.
No, that's, and it sounds after like Penny needs all the practicalities that she can get at the moment.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yeah.
She's in misery now.
Yeah.
She's absolutely in misery. Yeah.
And do you think Penny
she's
would sit in a bath?
Skin as well.
Yeah, that's the thing.
I would certainly try it, or I would even use the bread soda in her wash, you know, if I thought
yeah.
it would help.
Yeah, okay.
Absolutely.
So try that, Anne.
Keep shampoos out of the wash as well for a while. Keep anything that might be an irritant just as plain
yeah.
as possible.
Okay. Okay, yeah. So Anne, you've got
okay.
two things there. Try the bread soda in the bath. And Siobhan has that tablet called Apoquil. Ask your vet about that and see how you get on. And you might let us know
okay.
how Penny's getting on, and hopefully she gets a bit of relief from it all. Okay.
And
oh,
if anybody
Sarah,
else
you sound lovely.
Sorry, who's that? Siobhan, is it?
No, Afra, yeah. I'm just saying you sound lovely and caring. Thank you.
Oh,
anyway,
thank
bye-bye. Good luck. Good luck with poor Penny.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you,
thank
Afra.
You very much.
And thank you, Anne.
Thanks, Sarah.
If
bye.
You hear of anybody else with any alternatives as well as the vet's way of doing things, I would be interested as well.
Okay, perfect. We do have lots more coming in on this. We will come back to it. But for the moment, we'll leave it there. And the best of luck to Penny and Anne. Thank you so much. 51551 if you want to get in touch.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
RTE Radio 1.
Hello, it is me, Joanne McNally, that melter comic from the south side of Dublin, and I'm off on a national tour. My new show is called Pino File. That's Pino File. Like most women my age, I file Pino. I'm going all over. Dublin, Cork, Killarney, Castlebar. Tickets available now from your local venue box office or on my website, joannemcnally.com. Oh, men invited also for diversity.
Entertainment updates on RTE Radio 1.
If you think you've seen all of Waterford, think again. From August 8th to 17th, the streets become the canvas at Waterford Walls Festival. It's 10 days of colour and creativity in Ireland's oldest city. Live mural painting, music, workshops, walking tours and more. Explore what's on at wallsproject.ie. Funded by the Arts Council and Waterford City and County Council.
RTE.
Supporting the arts.
Ek taku lesh na haliana.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. The outlook just got even brighter with further reductions all summer. In-store or at harrycurry.com.
Get in touch with Liveline on 0818 715 815.
We were talking about motorway driving etiquette on the programme yesterday, and lots of you were getting in touch on 51551, the phone number 0818715815. Tom joins us now. Tom, what did you think about the conversation?
I thought it was very interesting, Sarah. Good afternoon to you. Very interesting. They would want to do a bit more training on motorway driving because people certainly do not know how to use motorways properly. They are a very safe way of travelling the roads.
Mm.
But people just don't know how to use them. They sit like in the outer lane and just tiddle along and oblivious to everyone behind them. Lane blindness, I think they call it.
Yeah,
they just sit there and drive on.
You have a bird's eye view, of course, Tom, because you drive a truck.
Yes, I drive a truck, and what I see on the road every day is unbelievable. The amount of people to be using phones driving down a motorway is ridiculous as well. You know, coming off of slip roads, a slip road is a slip road. Meet the speed of the motorway and merge out. It doesn't happen to slow down, to speed up. They don't know what to do. People don't know how to use or enter a motorway or leave the motorway. I've often seen them go across the lanes to get off at an exit because they nearly missed it. And, you know, it's the ethic of driving in the country is absolutely abolical.
OK. So, Tom, stay with us. We've Paddy Reynolds also on the line. Paddy, what do you think about all this?
Yeah, hi, Sarah. Yeah, I just happened to text in yesterday on yesterday's segment as well, too. I agree with that man there, all right. Yeah, the standard is pretty poor. When I texted in yesterday, I was actually triggered by one of your callers using those terms, fast lane and slow lane. Mm. And it's just a reflection, really, of the misconception, really, of how the system works. You know, we don't have that. And I realise he was talking maybe about the Netherlands and that, but we have an overtaking lane, and the rule is you keep left as much as possible, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah. So, do you reckon, Paddy, it's mostly the cars that are at fault, or, you know, some people say, like, the trucks could be...
There's a few things, I suppose. I mean, I think ultimately our road network is massively, not up to scratch, and that causes impatience and frustration among drivers. In terms of motorway driving, you know, I think you'd see a lot of people not maintaining a steady speed, you know.
Yeah.
And somebody might overtake you, and then they slow down in front of you. And then what you do, you're trying to maintain a steady speed, you have to overtake as well, too, and I'm sure the truck driver probably sees that as well, too. But I know there was another point there on truck. You have one of them on there. I do notice a lot of them. The standard for truck driving has gone down a lot, in my observation, over the last 20 years. I see a lot of trucks exceeding the speed limit on national roads. It's supposed to be 80 kilometres per hour. That's the fastest they can go, apart from a motorway. And aggressive tailgating and that as well from them as well too. So I think it's across the board, really.
Right, okay. Well, I suppose if it's happening in cars, it's not a surprise it's happening in trucks. I don't know, Tom, what do you think of that? Would you agree with that? I'm sure it's not yourself.
Oh,
now,
I agree with Paddy.
Yeah,
I agree with Paddy 100%. My truck is governed to 90 kilometres an hour. There is other trucks out there, companies have them governed to 80 kilometres an hour. And yes, I do see it in tailgating and truckers getting frustrated coming up behind cars, sitting in the lane, not getting out of the way. But we do a course every year. One day a year we have to go and do and learn about safe driving and this, that and the other. And that's every year we have a license.
Yeah.
And decide to drive a truck, like, because if we don't have the driver qualification card, no company will take you on.
Yeah, that's a bit comforting, actually, because, you know, when a truck tailgating you is much more intimidating and dangerous than a car tailgating you, or that's my feeling of it anyway, you know, if I saw a truck, just the damage they could do, you know.
Of course.
You have, you've worked in London, and I think this is really interesting, training to drive trucks in London. You had to sit on a bike to get a bike's perspective.
Yeah, I had to drive into London City, I had to do a day course to get the perspective of a bicycle, and I had to cycle a bicycle around, not in London itself, but in a training course, and learn what the bike sees. But on that point then, you never get a cyclist to sit in a truck to see what we see. We can't see them all the time. We do have blind spots in the truck, like, you know.
So, that's very interesting, but I want to ask you about the bike, first of all. How did that go for you? I mean, did that change your perspective as a truck driver, being on the bike?
You learn every course you do, you learn something new, and yes, you watch. And he would, the instructor was telling us how, like, you know, a cyclist would see a pothole and swerve out and not think about anything coming behind them.
Yeah.
So you kind of watch, and being a truck driver, we watch everything, we see everything, nearly everything, and we watch two or three cars in front of us to see what's happening along with in front of us, right in front of us. You know, it's just experience gives you that. And new drivers coming on today, they wouldn't have the experience, but they'll get it as they drive along the roads and that there, you know.
So it would be good then, really, if it was possible for drivers to get some experience of what it's like to drive a truck. Now, I'm sure that's, you know, that's probably not possible on the roads, because I know it takes an awful lot more skill to drive a truck than it does to drive a car. But even maybe just to sit up and, you know, drive with a truck driver.
As I see in London, in the centre of London, they would have a truck there with the arrows on the ground and get cyclists to sit into the truck to give them, let them see what a truck sees.
Right.
And right beside you here, you can see him. You know, on your left-hand side. On your right-hand side you can, but you can't see him on your left-hand side. And that's where they're sitting, beside the footpath.
What do you think about that, Paddy?
They're cycling up beside you.
Would that be a good idea, do you think, for everyone to get into the perspective of other road users?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, I think so. I dare say, Tom, you're one of the old stock of truck drivers. I don't think many of the newer qualified drivers get that at all. But from my perspective, driving on the road is a combative experience now at the moment. It's not pleasurable to drive anymore. You know, there's a serious lack of courtesy and skill. And in combination of those, you see a lot of stupidity on it. But certainly anything that can help to improve the consideration between drivers. I see a lot of heedlessness about, especially like more vulnerable road users, like pedestrians or cyclists. So a driver approaching a junction, shall we say, fails to stop at the stop line and only looks to the right and proceeds to basically blindly go around the left-hand turn at the junction blind.
Yeah.
And if there was a pedestrian or anything there, they haven't really checked. You know, this kind of lack of skill, observation and courtesy is massive, I believe, you know.
Okay.
And I think it's much more than speed, you know. RSA is on about speed a lot, but driver skill, courtesy, and that has deteriorated, in my view. Anyway.
Yeah. No, I don't think you're the only one, Paddy. Listen, thank you both very much for joining me. That's Paddy Reynolds and Tom, who is driving a truck. Really interesting ideas there from Tom about how we could learn to treat each other differently on the roads. 51551, if you want to get in touch, the phone number 0818 715 815. Now, yesterday we were speaking about the experience of parenting adults with special needs, and we're joined now by Enda. Enda, you're very welcome to the programme. Enda O'Brien, tell us about your own circumstances.
Good afternoon. Myself and my wife, we have a son, Hugh. He's 31 years of age, who would have a mental age of about 3. I suppose Hugh and us are fortunate in that we don't plan to rely on the HSE for long-term residential accommodation, because we are chopping up our home to divide it, to create a two-bedroom apartment for Hugh himself. So we're fortunate, and Hugh is fortunate, but unfortunately, for most people like that, that isn't the case.
So tell me a little bit about Hugh then. How does his day look, and for yourselves as well?
Like many others, Hugh goes to a day service, so that's 30 hours out of the whole week. So he goes from 10 o'clock in the morning, and he's home at 4 o'clock, 5 days a week. For the rest of the time, it's Jill and I are playing, not playing, but doing tag parenting. Somebody has to be with you all the time.
Okay. Which is,
now,
I imagine, very tiring.
I'm 71. My wife's 67. We're not getting any younger, right? So, we consider ourselves fortunate like that, because let's say both of us are still alive. You had people on over the last few days like that, and widows who are on their own, some very ill. That is a serious crisis right there. But I suppose rather than talk about any one of us right that, is to give you an idea of the number of people we're talking about.
Mm.
There's about 14,500 people in the country who have a primary carer, most of whom are parents, or else a wife or husband, or else a sibling. And at least 5,500 of those are over the age of 60.
Yeah.
So it is a really, really serious crisis.
And the stress.
And this is just
this
the
is
adult
putting,
cohort.
Yeah, and the stress from the people that we've been hearing from, the stress this is putting on parents, and the worry and the anxiety, because you're doing everything you can to care for your child at the moment, but there's nothing you can do when you're gone, and you don't know what's going to happen.
You don't. And I mean, like the way the system is at the moment, like I know that Micheál Martin has called it his number two priority, sorting out the disability sector. But you have five separate government departments reporting into him. Now, how the hell you get anything done with five, you know, that it takes five different government departments to create anything? I suppose what we'd be looking for right that is that seeing that we have a Minister of Disability and she's a local lady, Norma Foley, that we know very well, right, is that for parents, right, that a first step, I think, would be to put everything under one minister. You know, if you're looking for housing for a person with disabilities, you have to go to the housing department. If you're looking for a care package to go with that person in that house, you have to go to the HSE. Okay. If you're looking for transport for the person in that house, it's the Department of Transport. So you're getting an idea of how difficult it is for parents on the ground just to get anything done.
But that's almost a full-time job. Ringing departments, emailing departments, filling out forms, trying to get someone to respond to you.
Worse than that, like somebody goes on holidays or somebody goes on maternity leave, the whole thing stops.
Right.
You have a situation at the moment like that, let's say with the Department of Housing. If, let's say, you have quite often parents are prepared to hand over their family home to, let's say, the HSE so that their son or daughter can be in the house for their lifetime. The Department of Housing now will not fund any refurbishment or upgrades to that house to bring it up to what's called a HICWA standard.
So
it is not a new house. So the Department of Housing are just interested in new houses.
So say in the case of your own house, although I think you're saying your own house is slightly different because you're in the fortunate position where you've been able to make the changes, have you? So that it's suitable for you. But other people who aren't able financially or for whatever reason to make the changes to their home, because it's an old house, they can't get the funding for those changes.
No, they won't. And even the HSE won't get the funding from the Department of Housing. Or let's say I'm on the board of St. John of God's Housing Board, St. John of God's Housing Board, right? Which is a charity, right? The Department of Housing has informed them recently, right, that for refurbishments, they won't get it. They won't get any money.
And have you seen anything change over the last couple of years, even the direction or the language around it or the, you know, how quickly things are being done? Because we are being told again and again from this government and the last government, you know, that there is a move towards, you know, more funding, more awareness, more services for people with disabilities. Are you seeing that on the ground?
Not really. The only care in the disability sector is crisis care.
And is that, do you reckon, what Hugh is going to be left with? Crisis care? Because that's what we've been hearing from other parents, that they reckon nothing is going to be done until they pass on. And then there's a crisis and their children, their adult children, will be put into crisis care effectively, which is so distressing for the adult children, obviously, and also so distressing for the parents, knowing that that's the route it's going to go.
I suppose Hugh is in the look, as I say, in the fortunate position right that he's got three siblings who are prepared to step into the trust that we've set up for Hugh.
Okay.
So they will take on our role when we go.
Okay. But it's all a fight.
It's all a fight. Oh, yeah. Since the day he was born, right? It's a fight. And it continues to be a fight. And I think at the moment now, let's say there's about 34,500, I think, people, adults with disabilities receiving service from the HSE. What isn't being spoken about is the tsunami, and that's all I can call it, right, of the number of people in the children's cohort. This would be 0 to 18. And these are the numbers for 2022. That's over 45,000 receiving a service from the HSE in the 0 to 18 category. Now, all of those, over time, are going to move into the adult category. So they will be looking for houses. Mm. They will be looking for carers.
Mm. And is the planning being done? Is the planning being done?
No. And I mean, like in this day and age, right, that you would have thought like that each of us is born, or shortly after we're born, we get a PPS number. And in a lot of European countries, they just project ahead. They sort of say, okay, in 3 years' time, we'll need to have a childcare for this for this lad or girl, and after that, then we'll need a space in a primary school with an SNA.
You know what's coming. You know what you need to deal with, so you need to put the bits in the blocks in place to deal with it. But anyway, look, Enda, thank you so much for getting in contact with us. I know you were in touch with the programme a couple of years ago as well, and unfortunately nothing has changed really since then for you guys, but thank you for getting in touch. And if you do want to talk to us about this, we've been getting so many calls and so many people getting in touch. You can text us on 51551. The email is liveline@rte.ie.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Visit one of our 44 stores across Ireland for quality curtains and bedding at great prices. Find your perfect style today.
RTE Radio 1.
Electric Picnic, the Music and Arts Festival. Immerse yourself in a recipe of performances and bespoke activities across 600 acres of rolling hills, green landscapes and forests of mystery. With unique spaces from Freetown, Cree, Mindfield, Salty Dog, Trailer Park, Global Green, Fishtown, Theatre of Food, Trenchtown, Hazelwood, Transmission, Spoken Word, Green Crafts, Comedy, Theatre and so much more. Only weeks to go. See electricpicnic.ie. Subject license.
Festival updates on RTE Radio 1.
It's almost 3 o'clock on RTE Radio 1 with the Airport Club at Dublin Airport. Your exclusive membership club for great travel perks. Join today.
Get in touch with Liveline on 0818 715 815.
Well, we heard earlier from Anne about her poor little doggy Penny, who has a grass allergy of all things for a dog to get. I didn't even know it was a thing, but apparently it's much more common than people might think. Bridget is on the line. Bridget, what can you tell us about your dog?
My dog, he's a Shih Tzu. I have him for, he's 8 now. But for about 2 years, he was like that dog, scratching red, raw. And I used to think it wasn't the grass and all that, and he was on medication, and €80 a month it cost me for medication for him for a couple of years. And somebody just happened to say to me, put him on a grain-free diet, and I did.
Do you mean like gluten-free?
Yes, grain-free, yeah. You get it in Dunn's and Naturo is the name of it. It's not expensive. And I never look back. I stopped all the medication. And since I started, I'm on the grain-free, all grain-free, nothing like treats or anything. I don't give him any of those grains. It's all grain-free.
And so is this like available in to buy grain-free food for dogs?
Oh, yeah.
Right, okay.
Winter Dunn's, I have it. It's Naturo is the name of it. I give him the gin and the wet food and the nuts. And it's far healthier as well. And it's cheap. It's cheaper. It's not much more expensive than the ordinary dog food. But I can tell you, it's a lot cheaper. And that
of course
happened. That took it. Now, it will take about 6 weeks for it to get out of their system, you know, the grain or whatever. But, everybody thought that the vet said, oh, yeah, it's the grass, it's the seasonal, it's this and it's that and the other. And the vet is not going to tell you to go on grain-free diet. But it was actually a groomer who told me. And actually, it was in another pet food shop said, why don't you try that? And I did. And I haven't looked back since. And he hasn't been on medication now for for about 4 or 5 years now.
Oh, that's so wonderful. Because, I mean, you don't want the dog on medication, if at all possible. Bridget, stay with us, if you don't mind. We've Aisling on the line. Aisling, you have a Jack Russell, is that right? Or you did have a Jack Russell?
Unfortunately, I don't anymore. She died just a year ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It was just when I was listening about Penny, and it's so distressing when you see them suffering like that. And it just reminded me, one time she did have a rash. She broke out all under her undercarriage, very angry, kind of nettle rash type thing. Luckily, she didn't suffer the same way. It wasn't a long term. But what worked really well, it sounds mad, but it was something I always used with my kids, was, you know, the Weleda, the German range. They do a range for children, calendula. It's marigold extract, and they make a nappy rash cream and a skin cream. And it's absolutely brilliant. I always found it brilliant with the kids. It's amazing. And I always keep it because it soothes and heals cuts very quickly. So I just rubbed that all under the underside, and within 2 days, it disappeared completely, the rash. It soothed her immediately and disappeared. And it's completely safe to use on pets.
Well, that's good, because I know, as you say, you use it on babies. I use it on my own babies, actually.
Yeah.
I found that great.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
It might not work long term for Penny, you know, if
Penny
does have a...
It might not work. I'm only thinking about something that might give her some sort of temporary relief. The other thing that occurred to me, and I don't know if it's... I didn't get a chance to look up and see if it's safe for pets, but La Roche-Posay do one for eczema. Lipicar Balm, and it's AP plus M, and I just came across it in the pharmacy one day. A lady overheard me asking a question, and she recommended it and said it had been a game changer for her son who suffered from eczema, and it's absolutely amazing. It soothes and calms immediately, but as I say, I don't know for sure if it's you can use it's designed for babies upwards, so I'd imagine it probably is.
Although again, you'd want to check first, obviously, before
you'd have to check. I intended looking it up before I got the call.
Did you ever try the bread soda, Aisling? We had a caller earlier suggesting bread soda.
I did at the time. I think I dabbed it on diluted and dabbed it on. And the other thing I came across, but I didn't try it at the time, is a 50-50 cider vinegar, apple cider vinegar and water mix, which is supposed to help with itch as well.
Okay.
And the other thing...
Bridget, were you saying... Do you want to come in there, Bridget?
Oh, yeah, I did. I used the cider... When he broke out, I used the cider vinegar as well.
Did you?
But that is only just... It doesn't actually...
Temporary relief.
Cure the, it gives him a relief, you know, but I think it comes from what within, the inside to heal.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
well, it did with your dog anyway. What's your dog called, Bridget?
Oopa.
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 Oopa. O-P-A. It's a Greek. It's a Greek word for definition of joy, and then it's also a German name for grandpa. So I'm told, but he was my dog. He was very aggressive. You couldn't touch him. You know, he just. You know, he was terrified to let any children near him because
he was so irritated. God love him. Okay, we've Mark on the line just very briefly. Mark O'Donoghue, you're very welcome. You used to breed dogs. What's your thoughts on all this?
Well, the family did, but just to give you the heads up on the, the cure, to ease the itching for a natural remedy would be the baking soda and add in some apple cider vinegar. And that cure is immediately or ease the itching immediately. And then long term, as one of your other callers in said, go to a natural diet. But what we used to, this is years and years ago, was we used crush-up nettles, put it into a kind of a nettle soup and add it into their diet. And the nettle soup is a natural antihistamine for the dog.
Oh, very good. So what you crush up the nettles and do you cook them then with water or anything first? Or?
Yeah, just gather some nettles, boil them up with a bit of water and crush it down. Just have it kind of like a soupy consistency.
Yeah.
And just add it into their feed every time you feed them, a little bit every time. And what you do is you build up their antihistamine. It's a natural antihistamine for a dog, if I put it that way.
Well, we have had some of the best tips today between apple cider vinegar and baking soda and now nettles. Who knew? Well, you guys did. I didn't.
Mark, we didn't have medicine back in those days.
Well, exactly.
We basically had to figure it out.
Okay, Mark, thank you so much. Bridget and Aisling, thank you so much. Hopefully that will help Anne and Penny as well. And I really appreciate all of you getting in touch today.